Question number one, Jan Logie.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Social Development and asks, will Budget 2020 make our community safer by supporting family violence services in Aotearoa, New Zealand? If so, how?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Tracy Martin.
On behalf of the Minister, Budget 2020 includes nearly $203 million in funding for services and support for all those affected by family violence. This includes victims and survivors, people who use violence and want to change their behaviour, and people who have experienced non-fatal strangulation. This sector has and continues to do incredibly important work, but they have done so without adequate funding for far too long, and we are beginning to fix that.
Supplementary. How will these budget initiatives support family violence services such as Women's Refuge?
Speaker. For decades, family violence and sexual violence services have not received the funding they need to do their work. We are changing that and finally beginning to fund organisations based on the actual costs in delivering their services, including provision for fairer wages, training, supervision and management of staff. I acknowledge Under-Secretary Jan Logie, who said yesterday, we want these services to be able to focus on their work, not running sausage sizzles to survive. And on Dr. Ang Jury of Women's Refuge, who said this will mean they can recruit and retain workers without burning them out.
Supplementary. Why is it important to fund services for people affected by elder abuse?
Mr. Speaker, data from the New Zealand Longitudinal Study of Ageing concluded that 10% of people aged over 65 and living in the community experience abuse. Elder abuse is a form of family violence. It can be physical, psychological, spiritual or financial, but it is often not recognised when we speak of family violence. I know that my colleague, the Minister for Seniors, has advocated consistently and is particularly pleased that we are now doubling the funding over the next 4 years for specialist organisations to respond to this specific sector of an overarching problem.
Supplementary. Why is the government putting funding into the response for non-fatal strangulation?
Speaker, it is well documented that strangulation or suffocation is a significant risk factor for future violence. People who are victims of non-fatal strangulation can be up to 7 times more likely to be killed. This government, building on the work begun by the Honourable Amy Adams, made non-fatal strangulation or suffocation a distinct offence at the end of 2018. The funding announced as part of Budget 2020 will support our police, health and justice systems to provide victims with the psychosocial help they need and properly resource and train forensic services to ensure successful prosecutions.
And how significant is this funding in the context of the whole of government response to family and sexual violence?
Mr. Speaker, these initiatives represent the second biggest budget package for family violence and sexual violence in history of New Zealand. It is only surpassed by last year's budget, which contained $320 million in funding over 4 years. It is also significant because of the joined-up, all-of-government approach which has been taken and which is essential to properly responding to and ending this terrible violence. I commend all the ministers and Under-Secretary Jan Logie and the respective chief executives who have come together to take collective responsibility for addressing it.
Question number two, the Honourable Simon Bridges.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by all her government's statements and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes. Particularly the government's decision to move to level two as soon as possible. This will mean on Thursday this week, retail, malls, cafes, restaurants, cinemas and other public spaces, including playgrounds, can reopen. On Monday, 18 May, all children and young people will be able to return to school in early learning. And on Thursday, 21 May, bars, under the provisions that already exist around Easter Sunday and Anzac trading for the week prior, will then after that be able to open under normal legislative provisions. This will mean that in 10 days' time, we will have reopened most businesses in New Zealand and sooner than many other countries around the world. This has only been possible because of the strong measures we have put in place and the hard work of New Zealanders who have all joined together and united against COVID-19.
Is Westpac correct that government debt is likely to increase by more than 50% of GDP in the next few years?
Mr. Speaker, for any future forecasting and speculation, I ask the member to wait as others are until Budget Day.
When was the last time net core crown debt in New Zealand was over 50% of GDP?
What I can tell you is that it currently sits under around the 20% mark under this government, which is lower than what we inherited.
Does she accept that every single dollar of debt her government borrows will need to be repaid with interest by future generations?
Mr. Speaker, absolutely, which is why we worked so hard as a government to reduce the debt that we inherited after the last government. I also want to point out, Mr. Speaker, that relative to other countries, we have come into what is a global economic shock in a much better position with debt relative to GDP around the 20% mark. That is better than the UK, the United States, than Australia. We came in better and we hope, of course, to come out stronger as well.
Is Westpac also correct the fiscal deficit in each of the next 2 years could equal, around $30 billion?
Mr. Speaker, again, I don't want to get into speculation around the budget, but what I think it is important to point out is this is a global pandemic. The impact internationally is being widely felt. New Zealand was never going to get out of this scot-free, but what we could do is take us into it in the strongest position possible. And we always said that what we wanted to do was prepare ourselves for any potential shock that we might feel. In fact, I recall it was not so long ago that many pointed out that we were running surpluses and questioned whether that was the right thing to do. We always argued that New Zealand is a country that needs to be prepared. We have been, and the rainy day has come.
Will this week's budget show government deficits for the entire 15-year forecast period?
Speaker, again, the member does not need to wait long to see some answer some of his questions. But again, what I also think it's important to point out is some of the forecasting that's being done or assumptions that are being made from international institutions, which I think gives us helpful context because New Zealand is not going through its own pandemic, we're going through a global one, does demonstrate that the likes of the IMF and the WTO have pointed out that New Zealand's relative position will be stronger than most. In terms of recovery, if my recollection is correct for around growth, roughly about 1% better than on average other advanced economies. And for the WTO, they are predicting that some of our trade is looking more heartening than, for instance, even Australia.
To limit the debt burden on New Zealand taxpayers, will her government reprioritise existing spending that currently delivers low value for money, such as fees-free?
Mr. Speaker, again, I think what we have always taken into account is that we have to be prudent in our spending, and we have always said that, and that's demonstrated in the fact that, Mr. Speaker, we did get debt down from what we inherited. We're also very mindful that when you're in a period such as this, that what we need to invest in is people and skills. We will not be a government that takes on a challenge and confronts it through austerity and cuts and by hurting people. Instead, we will invest in people. That equally is the best way to stimulate the economy, get growth going, and get us into a better position to recover.
The Right Honourable
Minister. Question. Could the Prime Minister assure us that there is no intention, and that she's had discussions with the Minister of Finance as well, that there is no intention to multiply New Zealand's government debt over 8 times, such as the last government taking government debt from $10 billion to $82 billion from 2009.
Mr. Speaker, I think what the member demonstrates is that, of course, that side of the House should have a good understanding of what significant global economic shocks can do to an economy, that can do to unemployment, that can do to debt. The suggestion from the member that somehow New Zealand now, having been through a GFC, will somehow isolate itself completely and feel no impact from this global pandemic is just incorrect.
Can she rule out extending the fees-free policy this budget?
Speaker, I will answer the same now as I have for every question. The member only need wait till Thursday to see what announcements the government will make, and I just simply won't get into any speculation he chooses to get into on announcements.
Can she rule out announcing a significant slush fund in the budget that her government can use in election year for anything she chooses?
Mr Speaker, again, I'm not going to get into speculation around the budget, but I think it would the member would do well to remember that we will be in the next year having to rebuild the economy and rebuild New Zealand. The election for many people is going to be at the back of their minds. Instead, we have to focus on what's best for New Zealand.
Question number three, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith. A point of order, the Honourable David Parker.
Sir, if I respond to the opposition shadow leader of the House, that paper has now gone to him and to the Chief of Staff for the opposition. And I'll actually also check that it's gone to ACT.
Probably email. Question number three, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Question to the Minister of Finance. Does he stand by all of his statements and actions?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr Speaker, yes, in the context in which they were made and undertaken.
Regarding his statement last week that, quote, it is far from business as usual, end quote, will his budget reprioritise spending from nice-to-have projects to saving jobs?
Mr Speaker, I am always focused on saving jobs, and creating decent work with good pay for all New Zealanders.
Question... Oh, sorry.
Supplementary. Does he stand by his statement on the 25th of March that measures, including the $6.25 billion business finance guarantee scheme, show that business and workers, quote, we have your backs?
Mr Speaker, I think the full range of initiatives that the government has brought in over the last 6 or 7 weeks are doing exactly that. In terms of the Business Finance Guarantee Scheme, the member will be aware we've made some changes to that scheme, and I continue to consider what other changes we can make to ensure it operates well. I would also add that since that scheme was put in place, we of course have also put in place the Small Business Loan Guarantee Scheme.
Does he accept that the government-backed loan scheme that he announced on the 24th of March has failed, given the scheme has only so far lent 0.37% of what it was supposed to have lent?
Mr Speaker, I don't think at any point we thought it would be $6.25 billion in the first few weeks of operation. So I don't accept the overall premise of the member's question, but I do accept, as I've said publicly, that that scheme needed to be changed from its initial design. We've done that, and I continue to look at further possible changes.
David Seymour.
Did he ever think it would only be $27 million in the first few weeks of operation?
Speaker, I think we have to put that in the context of the overall amount of lending that banks have done in this period, around $5 billion worth of additional support that they've provided. As I said, the scheme has been tweaked. I'm considering further tweaks, and obviously, as of today, in fact, applications are open for the Small Business Loan Guarantee Scheme, which we announced subsequent to that scheme.
What was the point of the scheme if banks were going to lend anyway, as the Minister just said?
Speaker, the point was to ensure that banks didn't just lend to the customers that they were 100% comfortable with. We wanted to make sure that medium-sized businesses in particular had an avenue to go there. That's why we guaranteed it at 80% of those loans. I've been very public about the fact that there have been some examples presented to me where I haven't thought that the scheme was operating the way that it should. We're continuing to work with banks on that. And I also would pick up the words of the Bankers Association about the point at which that particular scheme may become more useful as people are more certain now that we've moved into level two.
Supplementary, has any cash been given back to businesses under the government's loss carry back scheme that was announced 2 weeks ago?
But Mr Speaker, I believe the Prime Minister addressed this matter in her press conference today, actually. I think somewhere in the region of $60 million has, and I expect that to grow considerably.
Can he assure New Zealanders that programs funded by the budget will deliver more than that $6 billion business finance guarantee scheme?
I think the member needs to look at the full range of support that the government has delivered, including the wage subsidy scheme, which has delivered $10.7 billion. All of the suite of measures that we've announced are important and useful. And yes, the budget will also contain ones that are important and useful.
Question number four, Kiritapu Allen.
Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance. What announcements has the government made with respect to Budget 2020?
Speaker, while the vast bulk of the budget remains for Budget Day, as is the tradition of governments of the past, there have been some early announcements. Mr Speaker, our plan to combat the global COVID-19 pandemic has three stages: respond, recover and rebuild. I have announced that Budget 2020 will focus on laying the groundwork for the recover and rebuild stages. It will strengthen our public services and provide significant investments to get New Zealanders back to work and to begin tackling some of our long-term economic challenges. These are necessary investments given the extremely difficult global and domestic economic outlook that is ahead of us. This will change our fiscal outlook substantially and, as I have said before, with higher debt and deficits for an extended period. I remain committed to managing our books carefully and responsibly. And right now, Mr Speaker, being responsible means investing money to support our people, our businesses and our communities to get through this and to rebuild.
A supplementary, sir. What announcements has he made regarding funding for health in Budget 2020?
This morning I announced, alongside Health Minister Dr David Clark, that Budget 2020 will deliver the biggest ever increase in the funding of district health boards. The different abilities of governments around the world to respond to the global COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted just how important it is to have well-funded public services like our health system. The $3.92 billion boost to DHBs is a 9% increase of funding, following on from 5% and 4.5% increases in the previous years. It is added to by $282.5 million for a planned care catch-up program. Mr Speaker, Budget 2020 will continue this government's record of tackling the legacy of underfunding and neglect of our health system.
The Honourable Paula Bennett.
Thank you. Will there be more money going to horse racing than Pharmac in this budget?
Mr Speaker, absolutely not, Mr Speaker. But since the member raises it, it is worth noting that the 15,000 people directly employed by the racing industry and the 60,000 people indirectly employed by the racing industry will be pleased to know that the government values all jobs in New Zealand, not just the ones the member picks out.
Supplementary, sir. What other announcements has the government made regarding funding for education in Budget 2020?
Speaker, on Monday, Education Ministers Chris Hipkins and Tracy Martin announced Budget 2020 investment of $320.8 million in early learning support, higher quality early learning for every child. This includes a $151.1 million funding boost for the pay of up to 17,000 qualified teachers working in education and care services, $122 million to fund a 2.3% increase in subsidy rates for education and care services, and additional help to professionalise home-based early learning and support for play centres. Mr Speaker, as we respond to the impacts of COVID-19 on our society and economy, we must have strong public services, including our early learning system, to protect and improve our collective wellbeing.
Question number five, the Honourable Paula Bennett.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Prime Minister, is her government the most open and transparent government New Zealand has ever had?
Mr Speaker, this government has certainly worked hard to be open and transparent, and we have done, for instance, a number of things to improve transparency, like for the first time, introducing a policy for the proactive release of ministerial diaries and cabinet papers. We've responded to record numbers of OIAs, with government agencies completing responses to 19,829 OIAs just between July and December 2019, compared to 14,000 roughly in 2017 for the same period. We've responded to a record number of written question requests, answering 103,117, so far this term, compared to 41,000 last term. In addition, just through COVID-19, obviously we've tried to make sure that daily we've been available. I've done personally over 30 press conferences. The Epidemic Response Committee was set up in the absence of Parliament to allow questioning and the opposition to have a voice and apply accountability. We released 317 Order. Documents on Friday as part of proactive release to provide COVID material. Mr Speaker, this is alongside reporting like weekly reporting from Treasury on the fiscals, weekly reporting now on benefit numbers through COVID-19 as well.
Did a leaked email from her office on Friday say that, quote, "I would like to sign off and see all written responses. Do not put Minister up for interviews on this." And if so, is that working hard to be open and transparent?
Mr Speaker, the member is quoting from an email from a member of my staff, so I feel I should just clarify that wasn't, when she quotes I, that wasn't a reference to myself. But I'm only saying that because, of course, it is not my expectation. It is not my expectation I receive those personal requests personally. Mr Speaker, we have received some feedback that the time of day of that release was an issue. We have given a commitment that we'll look to provide that kind of information now in mornings, and that we will signal in advance when that information is being provided to try and ease, for instance, the gallery's coverage of what was a large amount of information that we did want to make sure that we provided for the purposes of transparency.
Did the Prime Minister see the memo before it went out?
Mr Speaker, no. I only saw the email in preparation for question time, anticipating that the member would ask me questions about it.
So if all communications have to go through the Prime Minister, then why didn't this memo?
Mr Speaker, obviously it was a reference to coordinating responses to a large amount of information, which is not unlike what the member did when they were in government also. But Mr Speaker, also, you'll note that I was not the first person to speak on these documents. Actually, Dr Clark was, and also Minister Shaw also commented on the proactive release.
The Right Honourable Wilson Peters.
Did the Prime Minister get any communication, because this is about communications, of thanks from Mr Bridges or Paula Bennett for insisting upon the 10 people at funerals rule so that the National Party MPs couldn't meet and roll their leaders?
I think there's just far too much irony in that question. Paula Bennett.
If, as she says, it is about lining up communications, then why did the leaked memo say there's no real need to defend because the public have confidence in what has been achieved, instead we can dismiss?
Speaker, that is not language that I would use. Again, to come back to the substance of the issue, what we're debating here is actually the release of 317 documents, and if the member would like to ask me any questions about any of those documents, I'd be happy to oblige.
Does she have confidence in the senior adviser that wrote the memo, and does she stand by the statements that he quite clearly made in the memo that there's no real need to defend because the public have confidence in what has been achieved, instead we can dismiss?
Mr Speaker, to answer that question, yes, I do have confidence in that member.
Is her office's belief that we can dismiss the reason officials are no longer allowed to provide an assessment of the regulatory impact of her government's legislation?
Mr Speaker, again, I refute the basis of that question.
Order, order. Just be very careful about the use of that word. Grant Robertson.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. With respect to the primary question, has the Prime Minister seen the letter from Dr Ashley Bloomfield, the Director General of Health, dated the 7th of May 2020, to the Honourable Simon Bridges, which corrects the factual inaccuracies that Mr Bridges presented to Dr Bloomfield at the committee? And has she heard whether or not Dr Bloomfield's had an apology from Mr Bridges?
Mr Speaker, I have heard reports of that exchange.
Is there a regulatory impact statement for today's COVID legislation, and why was that legislation, if we're working with the most open and transparent government, only given to the opposition less than 24 hours ago when the government's had weeks to work on it?
Mr Speaker, that member has that legislation because we provided an exposure draft for the opposition. Equally, we're providing it to others who have an interest in this area because these are extraordinary times.
Order! Order! Can the people just stop shouting the Prime Minister down, the two senior members of the opposition?
Mr Speaker...
You were. Stand, withdraw and apologise.
I withdraw and apologise for arguing with you.
Stand, withdraw and apologise without any reflection on the chair.
Withdraw and apologise. Mrs Speaker, I am very happy to answer the member's question, though. There is no expectation or assertion here from the government to do anything other than try and be open around pieces of legislation that we're having to work at great pace on. There is no politics in a pandemic response, but there is an issue around, of course, timing. As the member is well aware, there just hasn't been the same time usually available for the full drafting of legislation and process that we would usually want. We've tried to mitigate that through, of course, the select committee process and members being a part of, and through providing documents and advice to the opposition as quickly as we're able to.
The Honourable Jerry Brownlee.
Why then did the Cabinet decide not to have a one-day select committee on the bill that's being moved through urgency today, as recommended to the Cabinet?
The Speaker, ultimately, it is about trying to get input on the bill in a meaningful way. The determination was we would try and do that through an exposure draft, because an afternoon at a select committee may not have been able to provide that space for meaningful feedback, and we are still seeking to do that through alternative means. Mr Speaker, I think the point is that effort is being put in here to do what we can in the time we have available, but the member would do well to remember this is a pandemic and we are working very hard under the circumstances we have.
The Honourable David Parker.
Is the Prime Minister also aware that the reason why that one-day select committee didn't proceed was that that would have left a one-day gap between the earlier Stage 2 start, which we've managed to bring forward by a day, but which would have left an enforcement gap had the bill not been passed?
Mr Speaker, that equally was a factor, but actually I also, members did discuss that we did want input from those who had significant interest and expertise in these legal matters, and we felt by directly providing an exposure draft that would give us the ability to try and do that as well.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Has the Prime Minister been advised that following the Christchurch earthquakes, Parliament passed legislation without regulatory impact analysis that also had an impact on people's human rights and their property rights?
Speaker, yes, and I know the member who's asked the question knows how difficult it is to balance speed, but whilst also allowing due process, and we have tried to do our best.
Question number six, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Mr Speaker, to the Minister for the Environment, what confidence does he have that there will be sufficient support in Parliament to pass all stages of his bill to allow fast-tracking of consents for certain projects?
The Honourable David Parker.
Mr Speaker, it's not for me to prejudge the determination of parties in this House. We do, though, have the support of governing parties to first reading and further consideration of the bill following the select committee process.
Does he believe that the process of introducing this bill meets the goal of being the most open and transparent government ever?
Mr Speaker, yes, in the circumstances, and I would note that the select committee period, which is yet to be determined, may be up to 12 days long, which in fact is 300% times the Kaikoura earthquake select committee process, which was just 4 days.
Does he realise that the Kaikoura process that he's just referred to one project and not to multiple projects over the entire country?
Yes.
Is it correct to say that this bill that he would like passed next month has not yet been drafted?
The drafting has not been finished, but it has been started.
What are the criteria that he will use in deciding which projects would be fast-tracked?
Primary criteria will be employment.
Question number seven. Oh, sorry. Supplementary question.
Could I ask the Minister, would that be required of the government? Would that be an essential for the government now if the previous 9 years of the previous government had it done anything whatsoever with the Resource Management Act?
Mr Speaker, if the RMA had been earlier reformed, it may well not be. In truth, the underlying RMA takes too long, costs too much, and has not protected the environment.
Order. A pair of senior members, just Let the Minister answer.
In truth, the underlying RMA takes too long, costs too much and hasn't protected the environment, and that's why we've got that root and branch review of the RMA going on at the moment, and I'm expecting a report back from that panel led by Justice Randerson, or retired Justice Randerson QC, before the election.
Does the Minister expect that the governmental parties will pass this legislation, and it's not going to throw the responsibility on other parties in the Parliament like the previous one did, who blamed members of the opposition when they had a majority for not passing their own legislation?
Mr Speaker, I'm confident that we will pass this legislation.
Question number 7, Kieran McInaulty.
Thank you very much, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of Education, what is the government doing to address low pay and funding disparities in early childhood education?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr Speaker, good news, Mr Speaker. As we respond to the impact of COVID-19 on our society and our economy, the government remains committed to fair pay for lower paid workers, especially the workers who have helped to get the country moving again. Yesterday, as part of Budget 2020, I announced $151.1 million over the next 4 years will help to improve the pay of up to 17,000 qualified teachers working in education and care services. A significant pay gap has built up over time between these teachers and those working in schools and kindergartens. Following a decision 10 years ago to stop passing on to education and care services the funding rate increases that kindergartens got to meet the cost of pay settlements. Now, from the 1st of July, the minimum salary for teachers working in education and care services will increase to $49,862, bringing it into line with kindergarten teachers' pay. Mr Speaker, we've got a way to go, but this is a very good start.
Supplementary. What response has he seen to this announcement?
Mr Speaker, teachers have welcomed the announcement. The NZEI, speaking on behalf of early childhood teachers, has described it as fantastic news. They've called it a significant first step towards pay parity for ECE teachers and a clear sign that the government is hearing the call to further invest in early childhood education.
Supplementary. How else is Budget 2020 addressing funding disparities in early childhood education?
Mr Speaker, I'm very pleased to say that yesterday, in conjunction with my Associate Minister, Tracy Martin, we also announced that there will be an extra $3.1 million invested in our Play Centre movement. This will help to increase funding rates for Play Centre from July, supporting more than 400 Play Centres up and down the country so that they can continue to provide what is a unique early learning choice for 9,500 children and their families. It means that Play Centre rates will increase by 7.6%, the largest increase they have received in a very long time. We consider that the ongoing sustainability of Play Centres would be compromised without this additional funding, and we look forward to working with Play Centre to ensure their long-term sustainability.
Question number 8, the Honourable Todd McLean.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of Tourism, does he know what proportion of tourism and hospitality businesses will be profitable under Level 2 restrictions without additional government financial support?
The Honourable Kelvin Davis.
Mr Speaker, many tourism and hospitality businesses will be able to operate under Alert Level 2. The government's economic package, which includes wage subsidies and tax provisions, is ongoing during this time, and I'll be announcing on Thursday additional support and assistance, including a tourism recovery package on Budget Day.
What does he say to those businesses that told the Pandemic Response Committee today that a large number of tourism, accommodation and hospitality businesses are likely to fail under Level 2 restrictions, even with further support?
Yeah, Mr Speaker, under Level 3 and 4, there was absolutely no tourism, no movement around the country, and under Level 2, it's the beginning of the recovery. The businesses have all been able to make use of the business support package that the government has offered them. And as I said, there is a tourism package being announced on Thursday.
Well, that was an answer. But is the event sector able to organise business meetings of up to 100 people under Level 2 from Thursday, if they meet the same social distance requirements as cinemas, restaurants or political party caucuses?
Mr Speaker, events are an important part of the tourism sector and drive regional tourism. Officials continue to work with them on what Level 2 means for them, and we expect a plan for the event sector early next week.
Why are government agencies cancelling meetings and events for the end of this year, as heard in the Pandemic Committee today, rather than providing support and confidence to the hospitality, event and travel sectors?
Well, Mr Speaker, as I said in the Select Committee today, that government agencies are just like any other business. If they can operate in line with the guidelines, well, then they will do so.
Minister saying that government agencies can't operate within the guidelines, and that's the reason that they are cancelling events and meetings at the end of this year and not showing support or giving confidence to the hospitality, travel or accommodation sector.
Mr Speaker, the government agencies are no different to anyone else. We need to obey the guidelines and follow the guidelines in order to make sure that we don't spread COVID-19. The last thing we need is a spike because people haven't followed the guidelines, and then we end up reverting back up the levels, which is no good for anyone, for the economy at all, or any tourism business.
Government agencies cannot organise meetings by following the restrictions and guidelines provided by his government, how can a single other tourism, hospitality, accommodation business in New Zealand plan to do the same thing today if the government can't follow their own advice?
Mr Speaker, the member needs to get his ears cleaned, because that's not what I said. What I did say was that the government agencies must follow the same guidelines as everybody else.
Question number 9, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health and asks, does he stand by the restrictions for Alert Level 2?
The Honourable Dr David Clark.
Mr Speaker, yes. In particular, I stand by the decision to use a staged approach to the resumption of some activities, such as the reopening of bars, which we know from the experience of South Korea can pose a particular transmission risk.
What is the public health evidence that supports a limit on funerals to 10 people over the original 100 people?
Mr Speaker, the advice I have received relates to the number of people at a gathering and the risks that pertain thereto. I have to say that in respect of funerals and tangi, this was one of the most difficult decisions that we had to take as a cabinet. I personally found it very challenging to work through, but we didn't want to see a double jeopardy, which has been seen overseas at funerals, where people come together to grieve and then the virus is transmitted, leading to further tragedy.
Does he agree with the President of the Funeral Directors Association that restrictions on funerals are, quote, a cruel and heartless blow to the thousands of New Zealand families who have lost loved ones and is unjustifiable, unquote?
Mr Speaker, funerals are a time when people naturally need physical comfort from each other. The decision to restrict that was not one we took lightly. I do disagree with those comments as they've been presented by the member.
What does he say to the family who delayed a funeral under Alert Level 3? Because the guidance for Alert Level 2 announced by the Prime Minister last Thursday included gatherings up to 100 people, only to be told yesterday that the restriction is now only 10.
Mr Speaker, I do reject the premise of the question, and I do again want to acknowledge that this is a particularly difficult issue for people. As I've said, I know that I found this a difficult decision to restrict the attendance at funerals, and I know the Prime Minister did, and other members of the Cabinet also. But we do not want to see community transmission, and we do not want to see the kind of tragedy that's happened overseas at funerals, where people have come together to mourn a loved one and then further tragedy has ensued. We hope that in a short period of time we will continue to see the risk diminished, and then we will see the ability for more people to gather. But when people gather, and in funeral situations, having conducted them myself, I know that people want to physically console each other, and it does not seem fair to put people in a position where there is risk to them and to the wider community.
What does he say to the man whose wife sadly passed away from cancer who has to explain to his young daughter that under level two, a rugby team of 15 can have physical contact and play a game, but that she can't have all the support she needs when she says her final goodbye to her mum?
Mr. Speaker, naturally I feel very sad for that family. This is the kind of situation that is not an easy one at any time when grieving the loved ones. In terms of the specific matters the member raises, I would observe that professional sport only at this stage is progressing, and that is with strict contact tracing in place. But equally, I'd go back to the main point that I've made before, that tangi and funeral are places where people come together to grieve and physically support each other. And this is a difficult thing, and I, as I say, am hopeful that in time we will be able to ease these restrictions.
Question.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Was the Minister encouraged by listening to a Polynesian undertaker on Morning Report this morning who set out that he fully understood the government's position and how difficult in the Pacific and Maori setting it was to keep people apart in that most difficult emotional moment at a tangi or a funeral? And he backed the government in the full
order
in what they were
Judith
doing.
Judith Collins has just lost two supplementaries to her side.
Sorry, Mr. Speaker, I missed the last part
of
the member's
question. I'm going to ask the question to be asked again.
Was he encouraged by the Polynesian undertaker on Morning Report this morning, who's understood in his...
No, the member can't interrupt a question if unless it relates to this question.
If you listen to me, I find it deeply offensive...
Order, the member will resume her seat. Winston Peters, complete your supplementary. Start your supplementary again, please.
Order, Madam, Mr. Speaker.
Sorry?
Point of order.
At point of order.
Right. That member just made a comment about his race. What did she mean by that?
Mr. Speaker.
Speaking to the point of order of the Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Thank you.
And just to make it absolutely clear, one may not interrupt a supplementary question for a point of order unless it relates exactly to that point of order. Once interrupted, however rudely, a further point of order can be taken. A point of order, or speaking to this point of order, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Peters has asked a question. My concern is that he has referred to the undertaker by that man's race as though that is actually relevant. Either he has a name, this undertaker, or he is an undertaker. Why is it necessary to bring the man's race into the issue?
That's a question. Woof. I referred to his race because he clearly understood the Pacifica or Maori tangi setting. That's the only reason why I referred to him, not to be ethnic or racial about it, but he just might understand more than some what the setting was all about.
Now, I just want to check the Minister's got the gist of the question.
I've got the gist of the question.
Probably from what we went back and forth.
Mr. Speaker, I have had representations from members of the Pacifica and Māori community saying that they understood the reasons for having this separation, and indeed it is very difficult to maintain physical separation in those funeral settings because of the desire to physically comfort one another and because of certain cultural practices.
Question number 11, Simon O'Connor.
If I might, actually, I think Paul Eagle's next, if you
sorry?
Don't mind.
Oh, sorry.
If you'd give us two subs back.
Member say he wants two subs taken away.
I'm not sure...
Well, the member better sit down. Paul Eagle.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Trade and Export Growth. What role does international trade have as part of the government's response to COVID-19.
The Honourable David Parker.
Our immediate trade response to this crisis has been to keep trade flowing with supply chains moving in and out and to push back against protectionism. Together with my Singaporean colleague, I led a process that now involves 11 trade ministers, including G7 economy, Canada, Australia and others, to push back internationally against rising protectionism. That has evolved into a bespoke supply line arrangement with Singapore and New Zealand. It's also led to another initiatives, including a New Zealand-Singapore declaration which eliminated tariffs on goods essential for fighting the pandemic. This practical action is, we think, stimulating some of the other measures abroad. An initiative with Australia, Canada, Singapore and Korea, where we're working together on similar things and the eventual movement of essential persons, is another example.
Supplementary. What are the next steps of the trade response to COVID-19?
With the measures I've already described behind us, we can now focus on the medium-term response, which we are terming the three R's: retooling exporter support by scaling up economic diplomacy offerings, including the trade barrier portal, our exporter helpline, our tariff finder website, and expanding market intelligence. We're refreshing our existing trade architecture, not just the WTO, but the China upgrade and the digital economic partnership, which we position as signature-ready projects. And, of course, we're looking to launch the FTA negotiations with the UK. And the third of the three R's is reinvigorating and refocusing our trade relationships as we turn volume to value and seek to diversify our exports and markets.
Supplementary, how will Budget 2020 support exporters?
The Minister of Finance will announce the details of the budget on Thursday, but I can say today that it's critically important that we reconnect our exporters with overseas markets. It's difficult for them to travel at the moment, obviously, so we need more boots on the ground as our overseas markets recover from COVID-19, because exports are critically important for New Zealand and our economy, and so our government will provide support for our exporters.
Question number 11, Simon O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question's to the Minister of Health. Does he stand by the restrictions for alert level 2?
Mr. Speaker, yes. In particular, I stand by the balance those restrictions strike between reopening our economy and continuing to keep people safe, by, for example, continuing to use physical distancing and limiting the size of gatherings such as funerals and church services.
Why has the government singled out temples, mosques, synagogues and churches for discriminatory treatment by effectively banning their gatherings?
Mr. Speaker, I reject the premise of the member's question, but what I would say is that in accordance with a cautious approach that seeks to manage the public health risks, the limit on gatherings is initially no more than 10. And I understand that will limit traditional church services, which do have close interaction between people. In fact, that is one of the main reasons for them to be held, is the fellowship that they have in those worship settings. The intent is to increase the limit over time as we become more confident that loosening controls is not leading to an increase in infection. The member will be unsurprised to learn I do not wish to limit church services or other religious services any more than is necessary to protect public health.
Are freedom of association and freedom of religion, as described by the New Zealand Bill of Rights, still relevant in New Zealand today, or are they just a nice to have?
Mr. Speaker, they are still relevant.
The Honourable Tracy Martin.
Did the Minister hear a Minister of the Cloth this morning on the radio saying how they'd been running their church services online and that while they understood that only 10 people could gather, they would continue to run their church services online, and actually they'd had more people come to their online congregation than they had in their in-person congregations, and they would continue to run online services post-COVID restrictions because of that uptick?
Mr. Speaker, I did not hear that particular interview. However, I can confirm that the parish that I normally attend has been offering services online in just that fashion.
No, the supplementary, the Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Can the Minister confirm that the restrictions placed on New Zealanders under Alert Level 2 are far more liberal than many other countries we would compare ourselves to, including Australia?
Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that. We are in the fortunate position of having gone hard and having gone early and having had a public willing to make sacrifices to ensure the success of that approach. And when we look overseas to countries like the UK or like Italy or Spain, other countries around the world, they are facing lockdowns and many more restrictions for time to come. Not only the economic consequences of that, but also the social sacrifices they're going to have to continue to make, all the while facing challenges with people dying from COVID-19.
Oh, question number 12, Karen McAnulty.
Okay. To the Minister of Health, what recent announcements has he made about what Budget 2020 will mean for district health boards and the services they provide?
Mr Speaker, this morning the Minister of Finance and I announced a record investment in hospitals and health services. We announced that Budget 2020 will deliver the biggest ever increase in funding for district health boards, as well as additional funding to deliver approximately 153,000 surgeries and procedures, radiology scans and specialist appointments to help clear the COVID-19 backlog.
Thank you. Why has the government prioritised this spending in Budget 2020?
A good question, Mr Speaker. Historically, successive governments have underinvested in health. One of the key lessons of COVID-19 is the need for a strong and sustainable public health and disability system. Budget 2020 continues this government's record of tackling a legacy of neglect. Around the world, COVID-19 has wrought devastation on underprepared health systems. It is absolutely critical that as a country, we continue to invest in and build up the capacity of our health system. That is what the government is committed to do.
Supplementary. What types of procedures will be funded by this new money?
Mr Speaker, the record investment in DHBs of an extra $3.92 billion over 4 years will help improve their financial sustainability and clinical delivery. It will also enable them to meet the costs of a growing and ageing population and already agreed wage increases. Ministers have also approved $282.5 million, including $50 million of capital to deliver an estimated 153,000 planned care procedures such as elective surgery, radiology scans, assessments and follow-ups and procedures completed in outpatient facilities. Although critical and urgent care continued even under Alert Level 4, we know that many procedures were delayed. Our hospitals are now returning to a more normal level of service, but it will take time to recover and deal with the backlog.
That concludes oral questions.